This Journey to a Dream podcast is brought to you by Kawasaki Insurance. Hi, and welcome to the Journey to a Dream podcast, where we talk to riders about what it takes to realise their ambition of racing here on the Isle of Man. Now, something slightly different today, we're going to hear from someone who's been there and done that. And while his story took a rather unexpected turn, he is undoubtedly one of the most inspirational people I've ever interviewed.
My name is Mike Booth.
Can you remember the first time you ever sat on a bike?
No, because I was about probably 3-4 years old. I can't remember not being able to ride a bike. It's just something that I've always been able to do because I learnt so early. I remember my uncle said to me one day, wobbling around, and I kept putting my feet down and couldn't really do it properly. And he said, if you can't ride that bike without putting your feet down by the time you're 4 years old, your willy will fall off.
We assume that happened. Obviously, you were able to ride around.
Yeah, I thought you meant we assume the willy fell off. No, I've still got it. Still there. I think growing up racing motocross, because I loved it, I always wanted it to be my job. I wanted to be a professional motocross racer. But I guess in the same way that like any, you know, kids that play football, they want to be professional footballers. Kids that sing want to be professional singers, don't they? It was kind of, I never knew whether it was a dream or like a realistic thing. But my mum and dad said, "You've got to work hard at school anyway, because it might not happen." So yeah, it was always kind of like, I want to race bikes forever, but I don't know if I'll be able to. So, and it was probably when I got a little bit older that when I started racing bikes on tarmac, that I kind of thought maybe like if I get really good at it, I can do it for a living. But I never really thought that. I never really thought I was good enough to be like a professional racer, but I just kept trying and never really got to the point where I was a professional racer. But I got to a point where I was racing in professional events. So I sometimes feel like I half got there. But yeah, I was never a pro, which is a shame. Dad raced bikes. My granddad raced bikes. So it was, yeah, it was kind of, I guess it was inevitable, really, that would be the thing that I did. So I remember when I was young, my dad was really good at motocross, and I used to watch him ride and think, oh, one day I want to be that fast. And I reckon I'm faster than him now, but he is about 60, so.
Did you grow up with like motorbike parts in the kitchen? Was it that sort of household?
Yeah. My dad used to like clean all the engine parts in the dishwasher because he said he needed to be really hot to like wash them properly, and he couldn't, the kettle wouldn't get it hot enough. So when he poured the kettle water of it, so he put, yeah, that was all our dishwasher got used for, really. Just washing engine parts.
Your mum was okay with that, was she?
No, she wasn't. So they got divorced when I was about 5 years old. So no, she didn't like that.
It's really interesting that you think you could class yourself a part way a professional racer. What does professional racer, I suppose, then look like to you? Think from other people's point of view, they would see you as that, given what you've done.
Yeah, maybe. Like, I think for me, a professional racer is someone who is paid a full-time sort of salary wage to race bikes, and that's their job. They don't have to get up on Monday and go to work, whatever that job may be. I feel like I got to a point where I could race bikes, and if I had a good event, maybe it would be like cost neutral because I would get some sponsors in, and the TT was always like reasonably good with prize money. So if I had a good TT, we could maybe do it without it costing loads of money. But I never made money from it. So it was kind of, yeah, I never really considered myself a professional. But then, like I said before, I think the TT is a professional event, and I raced a lot of years in British Superbikes or British Superstock, which was like fairly professional. I raced at Le Mans 24 Hour, which is like a massive event. So I felt like I raced at professional events. I was a professional level racer, but I was never actually professional myself.
So to get to those professional level events, when you talk a little bit about sponsorship and financing it, how was that side of things for you?
Like for most people, difficult, because racing bikes is just phenomenally expensive. You know, a set of tyres, for example, is like 300-400 quid now, and they might last one session. The fuel that the bikes go through, having a truck to take you there, the infrastructure and entry fees for stuff, it's massive amounts of money. So it's hard work, and I spent a lot of years working really hard to earn enough money to be able to do it. My dad spent a lot of years working really hard to earn enough money so that I could do it. He put massive amounts of money into me. The older I got and the better I got better at finding sponsors, and that made it easier.
And how does that side of it work? I mean, do they just notice you at a particular event? Do you just go round, you bash, phone bash? I mean, how do you find them?
It kind of works in all different ways, really. Like sometimes it's just, a mate in the village who's done all right, has got a business and wants to put his business on the side of your bike, so he'll give you a few hundred quid and that'll pay for some fuel. Or it might be, one of my sponsors, he owns a bar in Hull called Surf Bar, and he bought a bike, covered it in his like Surf Bar logos, and said, "Here, this is my kind of sponsorship contribution. You ride that bike," which was great. Other sponsors aren't that bothered about having the name on the bike; they just want to come and be part of it, so they'll give you some money to be part of it. And there's no kind of one hard and fast rule, really. A lot of sponsors, when you get to the bigger teams, a lot of the sponsors are kind of more corporate, so they want to be able to bring clients along to the events, and they want the riders to make a bit of a fuss of them. But that's kind of bigger teams with big hospitality and stuff. I was never in a team that was big enough to be able to kind of do that. So, but yeah, like there's a million ones where you can make sponsorship work.
And I suppose there is an element, there's a reciprocal arrangement there, isn't there? So you get money, and in return, you have to do whatever it is they demand, I guess.
Yeah. And hopefully that's something that you're able or willing to do. But yeah, whether that's promoting the business, making a fuss out of the clients, or it's usually a promotion thing. I mean, I know some sponsors kind of just like the idea of being involved in it, but when you get to the higher end stuff, when you're getting more money, and when it's proper businesses giving you like sensible amounts of cash, they need to see some sort of return for it, because it's a business, isn't it?
So then you've done the British Superbikes, British Superstock. At what point did you think, right, Ironman TT, that's what I'm going
to
do?
I came here in 2011, I think it was, with a mate, just for like, we had a few weeks off work. So in fact, I'd just finished university. So like I had like a summer holidays. So me and my friend Johnny said, let's go to watch the TT, because we had some mates over here that were racing. So we thought, we're going to watch the TT, have a few beers, just enjoy it as a little holiday. And then, the first bikes that I saw, I was like, oh man, I've got to do this. I have to do this. But at the time, I would have been about 20, 21, so I was crashing a lot. I was reasonably quick and having decent results when I finished, but I used to crash all the time. So it was kind of explained to me by a few people that it's not a good idea that you go and race at the TT. Not yet, anyway, because it's not a great place to crash around here. So I kind of waited a few years and got. I didn't really get any faster, but I became a better rider because I stopped crashing. So it was when I was 25 that I kind of decided that now I feel like I'm ready to do it. And I spoke to my dad, who has always been a big part of me going racing. And he said, yeah, I reckon, like, let's do it. Let's see if we can make it happen. So we did. I spoke to a kind of bunch of teams that I knew were thinking about coming over. And there was a guy who said he was interested in coming over with a newcomer, so I spoke to him, and the rest is kind of history, really.
And in terms of what you have to do in terms of racing fixtures, almost, because I think they talk about getting signatures and things like that. Can you just explain that side of it?
So you have to have a mountain course license to race at the TT, and to have a mountain course license, there's I can't remember the exact details, but I think you need to do 6 different race meetings, or at least 6 different race meetings in the 12 months leading up to the TT. I think they've got to be on at least 3 different circuits, and 2 of them have got to be within 6 months of the TT. So there's kind of a few hoops that you've got to jump through in that regard. But then it's not just a case of do 6 meetings and then come and do the TT. It's to even think about starting that process, you kind of need to be particularly the TT. I know the Manx is the pace is a little bit slower and it's a different kind of event, but for the TT, it's you've got to be like reasonably proficient, shall we say, and quite experienced.
And did you never think about the Manx first? Was that not an option for you?
I spoke to a few people and about it, and I felt like if they would let me go to the TT first, I would, and I'm glad I did, because I think you get more help with Milky spent hours with me in the car doing lap study, Johnny Barton, and I just felt like there was a better system in place to kind of help newcomers at the TT. So it, yeah, it was for me, it was if I could get an injury at the TT, yeah, that's the way I'd do it. So, and I'm glad I did.
So you did what you needed to do, and then you talk about going round with Milky and John Barton, and you see this quite often now on some of the television coverage, and it's literally, I love how animated Milky gets, particularly even when he's going around at 30 miles an hour in his car. You know, his drive and enthusiasm for this event is just hugely infectious, and I'm guessing from your point of view, it just kind of takes it to that next level.
Yeah, it does, yeah. Like, you spend time, when you're in the car with Milky, you just... You're living it with him. It's amazing. Like you said, he's got so much enthusiasm, and the whole time he's got a big smile on his face, and that's infectious, and it makes you even more excited to do it because you can see how much he loves it. I remember thinking, you know, people would say to me, "God, you're watching more onboard videos. You're going over again to do laps," and I was like, "It must be a bit of a pain spending all that time trying to learn it." But for me, it wasn't a pain. I loved it. I loved watching the laps. I loved spending time over here learning it and studying it and thinking about it. And you know, the sort of 6 months leading up to my first ET, I would probably, almost every night before I went to bed, I would just lay there with my eyes shut and just, like, you know, do a lap in my head. But I loved it.
So you arrive, 2016, you've done all this preparation, you're literally living and breathing it in your head. Were you absolutely ready for it?
At the time, I thought I was ready. I thought I was totally ready, but now I look back, I probably wasn't. I'd done a lot of riding, but I hadn't done anywhere near enough riding on the bikes that was coming over here on. I was riding a Kawasaki ZX-10, and we brought a BMW S1000RR and a CBR600. The CBR600 wasn't so bad because I'd raced one a few years ago, and I kind of knew the bike, and they're a bit slower and easy to ride anyway. But the BMW was faster than anything I'd ever ridden. The electronics were a lot different, and so whilst I thought I was ready, I could have been a lot more prepared. I mean, I feel like I knew my way around as well as anyone could, but the other bits were maybe not as well prepared as I thought. But I mean, it still went really well. We had a good week, and the weather was really nice in 2016, like we've had this time. So it's
the weather's always nice here.
Yeah. Keep telling yourself that.
So you arrive and you're in that paddock atmosphere. I suppose there's not a great deal of time to sort of get your head together before the first qualifying starts. How well do you remember sitting on the start line for the first time?
Yeah, really well. And I can actually, I remember I was the first person behind Milky Quail on the so they do the speed control laps first before any laps, before anyone else does anything, or they did that year anyway. I'm not sure if it's the same now. So I remember sitting there, and I remember thinking, I'm going to be the first competitor to set off in the Isle of Man TT 2016, like, you know, behind Milky, but Milky wasn't racing, so I felt like I'm opening the show. It's me. I'm like the first person to go around. So I remember that was pretty cool. And then when Milky set off, I just remember thinking, Jesus Christ, like, I can't keep up with him. And so I set off directly behind Milky, and by the end of the lap, like, there was four of the other newcomers, they'd all passed me, and like, I was really struggling to keep up. And I remember thinking, oh God, I might have bitten off more than I can chew here. And I remember thinking, what a waste of time learning it all and spending all that time coming over and doing, like, going around in the car. It's totally different when you're on it. When you've got both sides of the roads, it's totally different. Wasted my time. I don't know if I can do it. So I said to the lads that I'd come over with, I said, look, this might be too fast for me. And they said, well, don't make a decision now. Just go and do another lap by yourself. Forget about Milky. Forget about anyone else. Just go at your own pace, nice and slow. Just have a roll around, see how you feel. So I did. And that lap was easier. Because I didn't feel like I needed to keep up with anyone. It was probably just as fast, but at my own pace. And then I thought, this is actually okay. So I did another lap, and then all of a sudden, I fell in love with it. And by like lap four, it was the best thing I'd ever done in my life. And that's when I started understanding why it was so important to spend so much time learning it. Because by the time I'd got sort of up to speed, kind of like 100 mile an hour laps plus, that's when you need to always know what's next. It's not so much knowing what gear you need to be in, or knowing what way braking markers need to be, because they change when you go in different speeds, but always knowing what comes next and knowing if it's a double apex left that's fourth gear or a first gear right-hander, because obviously if you get it wrong it's going to hurt. So, and you can't commit unless you fully know what's next. So that's why it was really important to have learned it so well. But I didn't. Yeah, the first couple of laps were just, it blew my mind really. And the straights were another thing that I'd, there was a few corners on the straights that, to be fair, that was the one thing that I didn't learn well enough. Like when you go up on the mountain mile, it's fairly straight for about a mile and you're flat out, but there are little kinks, and I never really bothered. I knew the kinks were there, but I didn't learn the kinks well enough because I thought, oh, well, that's not a problem, that's just flat out. But actually, when you're going 180 mile an hour, it becomes a problem. And you can do it flat out, but you've got to be just in the right place on the road, and you've got to turn the bike just at the right time. And it was probably that first night race, well, qualifying here, was probably the biggest learning curve of my whole racing career. So yeah, it was frightening, to be honest.
Did you have your dad over with you?
Yeah. He came over. Yeah. Since I've been racing road bikes, I can't think of any time that I've raced anything with my dad not there. He's always been part of it, really.
I wonder what it was like for him waiting for you to come back that first time.
Yeah, I think, do you know what, coming here this year and not racing has made me realise a little bit more what that's like for other people. I think it's torture for 17, 18 minutes at a time, isn't it? So I think it's way easier, that side of it is way easier when you're racing, because you're concentrating on what you're doing. You're not worrying about where anything really apart from what's coming next. Whereas, yeah, them guys are just stood around kind of kicking the heels for 20 minutes at a time, not really knowing, if the bike's broken down or you've had a crash or something's gone wrong, or if you don't come round, then it's kind of like a proper panic then, isn't it? So I used to always take my phone with me. I slot my phone in my leathers. So just in case I did break down or stopped anywhere, I could ring them straight away and say, look, just to let you know I'm all right, but the steering damper's broken, so it's kind of no stress. One of the most difficult things about coming racing and being part of a race team, that waiting, because you're completely helpless, aren't you? Like, you've done as the team, whether it's, my dad or the guys coming to help or even the big teams, once you set your rider off, there's nothing you can do at all. I kind of wouldn't really like to be in that position.
So we get to race week in 2016 then, and it's fair to say it went okay, didn't it?
Yeah, it went all right, yeah. We started five races and I finished all five races. That was kind of, for me, I wasn't really interested in where I finished. It's nice to have a good finish, but I wasn't really interested in that. I just wanted to do as many laps as I possibly could, and to start five races and finish five races, I thought that was like, I was over the moon. And did 122 and a half mile an hour lap, I think, something like that, which isn't like incredible. I know a lot of the newcomers are going way faster than that, but I was really happy with that. I knew there was loads in reserve, and I never had any scary moments. I never got lost. So a few people said to me, oh, just go steady, because eventually you'll at some point you'll forget where you are and you'll forget what's coming next. And I never forgot what was coming next, so I felt like quite proud of myself for that. And I was fastest newcomer that year, so they gave me a big trophy and that was quite cool. They didn't let me keep it though, which was a shame.
Was there any question about whether or not you were going to come back in 2017?
No, as soon as the TT finished, we then started sorting 2017 out, and it was, as far as I was concerned, it was definitely going to happen. Unfortunately, the sponsor pulled out like literally the week before. So
did you find out why that was? Is it
because I think he'd bitten off more than he could chew, and didn't really let us know until the last minute, which is really difficult, because I actually had a bike at home that I could have got ready if I'd have known, and I could have made something happen. But it was kind of like, oh no, we're definitely on, and then all of a sudden we weren't. So that was a bit of a kick in the teeth. I came over anyway, because the thing is, I'd booked 2 weeks off work. My ferry was booked on the lorry. I'd done all my side of it. I'd got my license. I'd done all that stuff. And I thought, right, I'm just going to go over. And I spent a couple of the first two or three nights in practice week chatting to a few teams and saying, look, is there any chance of... but no one, either no one wanted me or they wanted me to like give them like $6,000 or something, which I just couldn't pull out of my pocket. So, yeah, so 17, I just watched. Yeah, sat on the hedges and watched and drank beer, which, yeah, that hurt a little bit. But I'm not the first person to have been kind of left in the lurch at the last minute, and I know I'm not going to be last, not in this game anyway. It does seem to happen quite a lot.
I mean, you talk to people who literally say that they spend their mortgage payments on parts for the bike just to get here. Yeah. And that seems to be very real for those privateers who just have this almost as their sole focus.
Yeah. It's, I know families that have remortgaged houses to pay for race bikes and stuff, and it's frightening, really. I mean, I never kind of, it never got to that point with me, but there was a lot of years where pretty much everything I would earn, or and most of what my dad would earn, and it was kind of, we kind of crippled ourselves a little bit. We never got into like debt or anything because of it, but it sometimes made putting nice food. We never struggled to put food on the table, but it wasn't always, we weren't having caviar and stuff like that.
A lot of beans on toast.
Yeah, there's a lot of beans on toast. Yeah.
So after you went through that monumental disappointment in 2017, how difficult was it to put any faith, I suppose, in the fact that you were actually going to be able to come back at all?
Well, so after that happened, we decided, me and my dad, we said, look, we can build a race bike. I had the makings of a race bike in the shed anyway. So
and in the dishwasher.
In the dishwasher, yeah. Yeah, so we said, let's empty the dishwasher, we'll build a bike. So we just said we'll do it ourselves, because we got them at home that we can fit the bike in the back. We had at that point, we'd been racing in British Superstock ourselves, like just me and my dad running our own little team with some help. So we said, we can do it ourselves. We know how the TT works now. I know where it goes. We can build a bike. It won't be the most competitive bike, but it'll get us round. And hopefully if we can turn up and put some sort of effort in, it might kind of open some doors for the following year. So that's what we did. We put my old Superstock bike back together that was, by this point, on its last legs, really. But yeah, we brought the old girl, and she's for 2018... just plodded around on that thing, and it wasn't the fastest thing, but I think that year managed 19th in the senior, and I think I looked at all the other entries, and it was the oldest bike by about 5 years out of anything in the top 20, so I thought it was a reasonable result, and we came, and I think I finished four races out of five, which, you know, on a pair of old bikes, I didn't think was bad. So, and it just kind of proved to me and my dad that we don't need to kind of rely on anyone else. We can do it ourselves. We did have help with sponsors. You know, it wasn't the case of we was paying for everything ourselves. We put a lot of my own money in, but we had some sponsors that helped and put bits in, and so for the following year we built on that, really. So 2019, we sold that bike at the end of the year. And bought a newer bike, not a brand new bike, because we just couldn't afford one. But bought a newer bike, and it was a lot more modern, and it was a lot faster. And off the back of having a reasonable result in 2018, we got some bit more help for 2019. And then, yeah, just did the same thing. Me and my dad, a couple of mates, Udlis would come and do the fuel for me. My mate Oatsy would come and do the visor change in pit lane. So it was just like me, my dad, and a couple of mates going racing for a couple of weeks. It was great. It worked really, really well. And that year I was 14th in the senior, so I felt like I was kind of just moving up slowly. And I felt like 2020 would have been a good year. And I thought, right, we'll take that bike back. The bike's still fast enough. There's more to go in me. I'm still not pushing as hard as I, you know, I've still got plenty in reserve. So, 2020 was kind of the year that I thought, right, let's see if we can get in the top 10, and off the back of that, get a proper ride on a proper bike. And but obviously 2020 happened and everyone got COVID, and the TT didn't happen. So we missed a couple of years, which was a bit of a pain, because I just felt like I was kind of starting to get somewhere. But
that's it. Circumstances totally beyond anyone's control. And I suppose so much had already gone into making TT 2020 possible for you at that point as well?
Yeah, loads. So it was a real, it was a real kind of like just takes the wind out of your sails. Because at this point, I'd raced since at the TT since 2016, but I'd missed 17, got 18 and 19. But like, I felt like even though I'd been racing since 2016, I've already missed 1 year, and then I missed 2 years for COVID. So I was like, I should have had like 5-6 TTs under my belt now, but I've only had 3. So it kind of slowed. I've just felt like it slowed my kind of progression down and slowed my bike racing career down a little bit. But then, same for everyone, isn't it? You know, the TT was cancelled for everyone, so it's not as though everyone was kind of getting a jump on me. But I just like I'm not getting any younger, you know. And I felt like to maintain the pace that I had in 17 and 18, I was doing quite a bit of racing. I slowed down quite a lot and became more difficult to do because of COVID and everything. So, like when we came back, I wasn't the same rider as I was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, just because everything had slowed down a little bit and life circumstances changed a bit, and so I just felt like that run that I was having just stopped really.
And obviously we know now 2022 was a memorable racing year for you for all the wrong reasons really, but before that had happened, do you remember much of the first part of qualifying week and how things were going?
It was going all right. I was actually a little bit ill. I had laryngitis or tonsillitis or something, which didn't help. It made things a little bit more difficult because I was just tired. But I mean, it was going well. I was on the same bike that I'd rode 3 years ago. So by this point, it was quite an old bike again. But I knew it was still competitive, and I knew it was still, you know, there was more in me. It wasn't the bike that was slowing me down. It was me at that point. So I knew, like, it would be fine. And it was going well. I was just slowly getting quicker each night, and then it was on the last night of practice, so the Friday evening practice. Did a couple of laps on the 600, and they went fairly well. And I thought about going and doing a couple on the big bike, but I thought, you know what, I've got this. It was a superbike race the next day, so I thought I don't want to wear myself out on the superbike or the superstock bike because I've got a 6-lap race to do tomorrow. I'm already a little bit ill. I'm going to leave that one there because it'll wear me out. So I thought I'd do it. But I'm feeling good and I want to keep doing the lap. So I went out on the 600, did one good lap, and then I was on another lap, which was the best lap I'd ever done on a 600. It was up until Joey's, I think. Like, every sector I was like 5, 6, 7 seconds faster. Then I got to Joey's, which is about 26 miles around the course, just after the gooseneck, when you start heading up the mountain, and I've crashed the bike. Now, I can't actually remember the crash, but I've spoke to marshals, and I've spoke to some medics, and I've spoke to people who rode through the crash afterwards, and kind of pictured what I think happened. So I think what's gone on is, evening practice, the last lap of evening practice, you're like 8 o'clock at night, you know, so it's starting to get a little bit cool, so I think maybe my front tyre's just cooled off a touch, and I've tipped into Joey's, lost the front, and I think the bike has slid into the rector cell in front of me. You know, the big soft bales. It's hit them bales, pushed them out of the way, and then I've gone in behind it, but straight into the wall because the bike's pushed the bales out of the way, and then kind of bounced me and the bike up the road, and there was just, like, stuff everywhere. The bike was all in bits and pieces. I was laying down, face down, with my legs all twisted and bent out of shape. And there was, like, stuff everywhere. So the marshals had to move me really quick because you come through there really fast, and they couldn't slow the riders down enough. So it was a big old mess, I think.
Is there any point now? I mean, obviously this is probably a stupid question, but thinking about the fact you hadn't felt great anyway, you'd been doing pretty well considering, where you think, God, I just wish I hadn't gone out for that last lap.
I've thought about that loads, and part of me thinks, yeah, I wish I didn't do that last lap, but then to not do that lap wasn't who I was. I was always going to do the lap. If someone gives me a bike, and any course, but, you know, any someone gives me a bike in any track, I'm going to go ride it. But if there's a bike there and the TT course is ready for open for me to go and rip round, I would have had to have been really ill to say no, and I wasn't that ill. I feel like to regret doing that lap would be to regret who I was, and I don't think you can do that, can you? I don't think you can, like, it's obviously we're talking with hindsight. There's no real regrets. Like, it's easy to say I wish I didn't go and do that lap, but I did, so.
How long was it before your dad and all the people who were with you, how long was it before they found out what had happened?
I'm not really sure, because I think it was, you know, reasonably quick, because I think the TT organisers are quite good at, you know, letting people know on the ground what's going on. But like I say, I don't really know, because I was otherwise engaged. They gave me this like a vape pen, you know, like when you're vaping. They gave me one of them, apparently, I can't remember, but they're for, it's like a, what is it? And like an anaesthetist, not an anaesthetist, and a bit of an anaesthetic, that's the word, isn't it? Yeah, they gave me this thing and it was a bit of like an anaesthetic. So that was like kind of like spacing me out a little bit and taking some of the pain away. I can't really remember what was going on, but I know they put me on a helicopter, and I guess by the time they've picked me up and put me on the helicopter, the organisers know exactly what happened. They would have found my dad, Udlus, who was my fuel man, and then Oatsy, and my girlfriend had just got there as well. So Kay just arrived, literally between, so I'd done two laps on the 600, she arrived, said hello to her, and then went to do the next two laps, and then all hell broke loose. So, but they flew me in a helicopter to Nobles, and I was in like a little triage room where they were putting like cannulas and catheters and straps and all sorts of stuff on me. And whilst I was in this room, you know, you're strapped to the stretcher sort of thing. And whilst I was in this room, my dad and girlfriend came in, because they'd obviously been brought to Nobles, and they came to see me, and I, like, was able to chat to them for 5 minutes. So I can remember that. Then they put me in a hospital, put me in another aeroplane. So they'd flown me to Nobles in a chopper, and then they ambulanced me to the airport, put me in a little aeroplane, flew me over to John Lennon Airport, I think, and then put me in another ambulance to take me to Aintree Hospital in Liverpool. So I had a bit of a journey. And then the next day, my girlfriend kind of followed me out. So she was with me in hospital. And then I spent the next 2 weeks, I think. I think we worked out that in 2 weeks, or in the space of 14 days, I was in theatre 11 times. So it was literally like in and out, like sometimes 14-hour operations, but because I'd done so much damage to my leg. So I'd broken my tib and fib, both sides, both femurs. I'd done a couple of vertebrae, a couple of ribs, punctured a lung. Not, I think I'd like torn a lung, not like kind of like properly punctured it. There was this other thing that they were really worried about. There was some air in my blood. And they were sort of said, if you've got an airlock, if you get an airlock in your heart, then you like have a problem. But that kind of, that must have like disappeared, because no one's ever like pulled me up on that. So, but yeah, my legs were in a right mess. So after I think 4 or 5 attempts to save my right leg, it was just too bad, and I got compartment syndrome, which is where it swells up so much that it like basically squashes all the blood vessels and veins and stuff. So my foot for the space for like 2 days or something wasn't getting any fresh oxygenated blood, and it just died. So once my foot was dead, they were like, well, we can't really do anything, so they chopped it off. That's I'm not a doctor, just to let everyone know, that's kind of layman's terms, so if there's any doctors listening, I've got that wildly wrong, I do apologize. But that's kind of how it's explained to me when I was off my nut on drugs. So
they followed months in hospital. Obviously the physical side of it you've been really open about, and you know, there was a lot going on there. What about the emotional and the mental side of your recovery? Was that ever anything that you considered, or were you just, because you strike me as somebody who's just like, well, you know, that's happened, how do I deal with it, okay, let's move on. But I think it's fair to say that wouldn't be true for everybody, would it? So I just wonder where did that strength, I suppose, come from?
Yeah, I think the strength came from the support that I got. Like there was so many people. You know, my girlfriend was like there for me, like pretty much the whole time. The only time she couldn't be there for me was when, so we were moving house just after the TT. So it all went a bit mad. So the plan was I was supposed to move out all the stuff out of my house. She had a flat and we were moving in together up in Scotland. But I was obviously unable to do anything. So she was doing all that as well as trying to be with me whenever she possibly could. And I just wanted like her next to me to hold my hand the whole time. And I can remember it feels like she was there every day, but I know she wasn't because I know she had all this other stuff to do. So, and like the support I got from, so I was working for a website and YouTube channel that had like quite a big following, and the support that we got from all the kind of all the 44 Teeth community were amazing. I was getting so many messages all the time. So I felt like it was, it's hard to, how can I explain it? It's, when you've got so many people being offering you so much help and giving you so much love, like I couldn't not smile. Do you know, I was reading messages and just I might have been laid in bed with like one leg off and like bits sticking out of me everywhere, but I just felt like there were so many people behind me. I couldn't not, I was always going to get through anything because there's so many people helping me. And also I think, you know, people have asked me about like the mental side of things and mental health and stuff, and I think because I feel like it was a big crash at a really fast corner, and it could have easily been worse. Like if I'd have gone into that wall head first, that would have been it. But I've gone in legs first, and it smashed my legs up. But it's only smashed my legs up. So, and I've still got one. Do you know? I could have easily have lost both. I could have easily been dead. So, whilst I've got a prosthetic leg now, I still feel like I've got away with it. So. It's like a, you know, I feel like it's like a bonus that I'm here. So, yeah, the mental side of it's, I'm okay. I do wonder, though, when I'm a little bit older and things start getting more difficult more quickly. You know, when you get old, things become hard anyway, don't they? And it's more difficult to stay fit. At the minute, I'm getting fitter the whole time because I'm doing loads of physio and everything's getting better. So when everything's getting better, it's easy to be positive. I don't know if when I get older and things stop getting better or start going the other way, maybe that's when I start struggling. I don't know. I'm hoping that I'm going to be all right, but yeah, up to now I've been okay.
And at no point was a part of you that's thought the TT's to blame for this?
No. It was my decision to get on the bike. It is a dangerous sport. Like, we know it's a dangerous sport. Everyone knows it's dangerous before you even think about racing here. So it's they don't force anyone to do it. You know, it's there for you to do if you're capable. If you, everyone thinks you're capable of doing it, but no one forces you down that road or forces you onto the bike. Most of my friends and family didn't actually want me to do it. But I wanted to do it, and I was the one that made it happen and got on the bike. And I was the one that crashed. Do you know, it wasn't a, do you know, it was no one else's fault. So yeah, there's nobody to blame but myself.
If it was possible, and the TT was happening tomorrow, and somebody said, "Right, we've got a bike there for you, you can do it," would you?
No, because my girlfriend had killed me. To be honest, I feel like I've done it now. That's a part of my life that I loved, but there's other stuff I want to do now. And to be honest with you, I think I could still do it if I wanted to. Like, I can still ride a bike with the prosthetic leg, and a lot of people do race and ride bikes with prosthetics and stuff. It's not the leg that's stopping me. It's the fact that I don't want to put my family through that, and don't want to put my girlfriend through that, who's soon to be my wife. The trauma that my family and Kay, my fiance, went through after the crash was, in a lot of respects, worse than my trauma, because I didn't have to do anything. All I just had to do is lay there and let them give me drugs. Yeah, I was in pain, and there was a bit of hard work doing the physio and stuff, but I didn't have to run around kind of like still living life, looking after me. And so I think in a lot of ways it was worse for them. So, I don't want to put them through that anymore.
Have you promised not to wash any bike parts in the dishwasher?
No, I haven't promised. No, I haven't promised, but I probably do it when she was out for the day. because I don't know how it would go down.
The whole point of this podcast series is really talking about people who have a dream, and that dream is to come and race on roads in the Isle of Man, whether that's the Manx Grand Prix or the TT. If there's somebody listening who maybe for them it's just an inkling at the moment, just that thing that seems so far off and maybe not quite possible, what would you say to them?
I think whatever your dream is, whether it's racing at the TT, been a famous singer, been an actor, been a captain of a yacht.
Are you just reeling off all your ambitions
here? Yeah. whatever your dream is, I always think you just always be ambitious and do what you can to make it happen. Even if them dreams are a little bit far-fetched. You know, my dream wasn't just to race at the TT. My dream was to win at the TT. So, you know, in one respect, I haven't really achieved my ambition. I haven't achieved what I wanted to do, but I've still, you might not get all the way, but you get, but I feel like I've done quite well. I got quite far. I managed to race at the TT, and even that itself, just racing there without winning, just racing there, that's something that people give an arm and a leg to do, and it only cost me a leg, so I got it half price. But no, always, you've got to aim high. Aim high. You might not get there, but you'll enjoy the journey, do you know? I want to be a MotoGP champion, and I tried to be a MotoGP champion. All I got was as far as racing in the British Championship. But my ambition wasn't to race in British. I loved it. It was amazing. But I wanted to go further. But you'll get as far as you get, and you'll probably have an amazing time. But if you don't have any aims, what are you living for? Do you know? If you're just going day to day without kind of hoping to at least achieve something, yeah, it must be boring living that type of life.
Mike Booth, who I think it's fair to say could teach us all a thing or two about acceptance and perseverance. If you'd like to tell your story, I would love to hear from you. BethSB@manxradio.com is the email address. You can find that link on the Journey to a Dream podcast page. And so until next time, bye-bye. This Journey to a Dream podcast is brought to you by Kawasaki Insurance.